He was the suburban pilot convicted of murder in the High Country.
The campers went missing.
Greg Lynn lost his temper.
I panicked to save myself.
But when I dug into Greg Lynn's past, I found long-buried secrets waiting to be exposed.
Everyone was scared of him. She was pleading, and I thought, this is not good.
Anybody that would kill their wife's pet is a monster.
Huntsman, the latest season of the ABC's true crime podcast, Unravel. Hear Unravel now on the ABC Listen app.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Once upon a time, hundreds of thousands of people from all over the world flocked to Rajneeshpuram, an ashram in Oregon led by the Indian guru Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh. Rajneesh and his flock of adoring Rajneeshis were media dynamite, exponents of blissed out enlightenment and free love, all decked out in shades of purple, red and pink. Martina Zanger was one of those idealistic young followers, and in 1983 she flew to America to live with Rajneesh. His cult ended up controlling Martina's life for much of the next decade. And once she finally gathered up the courage to leave the Rajneeshis, Martina was left to face the trauma that she'd buried since she was a little girl growing up in Switzerland. These days, Dr. Martina Zanger is a counsellor and psychotherapist who specialises in helping women and children who have been victims of abuse. She also trains aspiring doctors in the invaluable skill of compassion. Her memoir is called Not My Shame. Hi, Martina.
Hi, Sarah.
Let's start with the work that you do now with those young doctors. What are you hoping to teach them?
I think doctors, medical students, tend to come from quite privileged backgrounds. They can be quite judgmental because of that. Oh, she should stop smoking. They're eating too much. Their BMI is 35. And yet there's always a reason why someone is smoking or in an overweight body. And so part of what I do is teach compassion to the students. I teach across the five-year degree.
How on earth do you teach compassion?
We do it through role plays. So we have lots of different topics that we teach. So, for example, how to work with angry patients, how to work with mental ill health, addiction, how to speak to adolescent patients in a way that makes them feel heard and seen and respected.
And do you see those, you know, young trainee doctors change over the
years? They do, because they have to do it every year for 5 years. And when I teach them, we have a paid actor who comes in and they get to practice on the paid actor who has a particular scenario. And so over time, they become really good communicators and they actually have to pass the course. So they have to work hard at this.
You didn't fall into this kind of work by accident, Martina. You've had your own experience with doctors and psychiatrists.
Yes.
Because of your childhood in Switzerland. Tell me a little bit about your life growing up there. How big was your family?
I had two older brothers. I was the only girl and the youngest. And my mum and dad were quite authoritarian. My mum was a very unwell, unhappy woman, unfortunately for her and for us kids. She had experienced abuse and trauma in her childhood, and she brought that into adulthood, as we do. If our wounds aren't healed, we repeat them. And so she had really poor mental health and was often suicidal.
How did that show up for you as a little girl? Like, what would you observe at home with your mum?
She had rages and she had fits of crying, and she would go to her room for long periods and lie down. So she would close the metal blinds and lie underneath her green and blue checked mohair hair blanket and take quite a few pills. So she was addicted to pills. And I was already a little social worker. And even at age 7, I would lower the toilet seat, stand on the toilet seat and look in the medicine cabinet, the red medicine cabinet above me, and check how many pills she'd taken and which ones she'd taken. So I was always worried she would die of an overdose because she might say before we went to school, I'm going to kill myself. My life is a living hell. I'm going to kill myself. And we would go off to school and I would worry all day that when I get home, she might be dead in her room. So I was in charge of counting and making sure she was still alive.
How were things different at the house next door to yours?
Yes, I had a beautiful neighbour, Lucy, and I actually named my daughter after her because she was such a beautiful best friend. And her mum was very special because she was so warm. And I think she must have sensed that I was a sad girl. And so all through primary school and high school, I would visit them often. I would spend as much time as possible away from home. And I was lucky in that I was quite a lovable girl, I think. And so the mothers I knew really embraced me in such a warm, welcoming way. And I felt safe and protected.
How would you and Lucy spend your time together?
Oh, my goodness. Very creative. We knitted a lot together. We painted. We played, this is in the 70s, Cat Stevens, Joni Mitchell, Neil Young. And we would translate the songs into German because we didn't know English and we had a dictionary and we would translate all the words and go, oh, my God, that's so meaningful.
Tea for the Tillerman in German.
Yes, like her mum was not a good housewife. My mum was extremely good. Everything was neat and tidy and spotless. But her mum, she had disorder in the house. The beds were often unmade and I thought that was incredibly wonderful to have disarray in the house.
So Lucy's place was a really happy, safe refuge for you. But as a little girl, Martina, you were forced to stay somewhere that was not safe at all, your yeah. grandparents' house, where you were sexually abused by both your grandfather and your uncle.
Yeah.
When did that finally stop?
It stopped around, I think, 5 or 6 when my grandfather died and my uncle then got married and moved away. So it went on for many years and lots of occasions. And thankfully it stopped at that point.
Did you tell anyone at the time?
I told no one. I was so scared. And I think even, especially in the 1960s, no one talked about sexual abuse.
And the idea that high-ranking, powerful, yeah. publicly respected men could have this other life was yeah. considered unimaginable.
Unimaginable, yeah. My grandfather was a high court judge and academic, and my uncle was a beloved politician and barrister. So they had so much power, while I had absolutely none, of course.
Your family, you and your brothers and your mum and dad, left Switzerland when you were 14 and yeah. came to Sydney for your dad's work. How did you feel at the time about moving to the other side of the world?
At the time, I was very sad. I was so homesick. By the time you're 14, I was very connected to my peers and moving further and further away from my family. And so I had become quite a lot happier. And so then I lost all my peers, moved to Australia, strange language. I remember thinking, it's a really ugly place, whereas now I find it beautiful, but it takes time to
very different from see Switzerland.
It. Yes, it's not as green and as picture perfect as Switzerland. Over time, I have come to absolutely adore Australia. Mm. But at the time, I was so homesick, I was... I remember I was sending letters to all my friends saying, can you send me $50? Can you send me $100 so I could get a plane ticket back to Switzerland. The school was very strange. It was a private school, whereas in Switzerland there are no private schools. You don't wear a school uniform. So all of that was quite off-putting for me because I was a little rebel.
As a teenager?
As a teenager, yeah.
How did you first hear, still as a teenager, about an Indian guru called Rajneet?
Yes, I had been to this rebirthing workshop, so I was always seeking healing. I had dropped out of uni because I couldn't cope with adult life at all after leaving school. So I had dropped out of uni. I was on a commune in the bush and they were holding a rebirthing workshop, which I don't recommend to others. And we met some Rajneeshis there and a couple who were just about to go to America to go and live with him gave me one of his books, Rajneesh's books. It was called My Way, The Way of the White Clouds. And I devoured it over 2 days and just fell heavily in love with Rajneesh.
What was it? What sparked something in you, do you think?
It's incredible, isn't it? I think part of it was I was searching for escape and I was searching for healing. And I believed that Rajneesh would heal me. That's what he promised his disciples. I will heal you. Follow me and I'll heal you. And I believed that and I felt convinced that I actually wouldn't have to do the work because it takes a lot of work to heal from trauma. And I thought it would just magically happen if I followed him.
Was there a community of his disciples in Australia at
Yes,
that time?
There were quite a few communities. So there was one in Sydney, which is the one I joined. It was on Oxford Street in Paddington. They had a lot of businesses. They were doing very well. I wasn't living in the commune. I was living nearby in Darlinghurst and doing the meditations at the ashram.
What did those meditations mean? I mean, is it sitting silently in stillness the way most of us imagine?
He had a very subversive view of meditation. So a lot of his meditations were active. And he said Westerners need active meditations because their head is so busy and they need to be brought into their bodies, into stillness. And that can only happen after an active meditation. So I went every day, no matter how late I worked, to the 6 o'clock in the morning dynamic meditation. And that had 5 stages. The first stage was chaotic breathing. So kind of hyperventilating and throwing yourself around the room. The second stage was catharsis. That was also 10 minutes. And the catharsis was basically screaming, crying, punching pillows, punching mattresses, walls, and having a 4-year-old tantrum. The third stage was jumping up and down on the spot and going hoo, 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 accessing the base chakra at the bottom of the spine. The fourth stage was silence. So that was actually, there was silence and he said, by that stage, you can experience silence. And that was actually true. It was a very beautiful space. And the last stage was dancing to really lovely Indian music.
Once you became a devotee, Martina, what did you start wearing?
Yes, so I dyed all my clothes, pink, red, orange, purple, maroon, and that's what we wore. We wore those clothes which are the colours of the sunrise, he said. And we also wore a mala around our neck, which was 108 beads of sandalwood. And at the end of the necklace was a locket of a picture, a photo of him. We were very noticeable.
And was it the ideal, really, for all Rajneeshis to move and live with the guru? Was that kind of the ultimate?
That was the ultimate, because the closer you were to him, the more you would be healed. That was our belief, and that is what he promised us. So he was a very good salesman.
So how did you go about raising the money to move to this ashram in America?
Yeah, so I was quite desperate to get the money, because at the time I was working as a sandwich hand or as a cleaner in a factory, or I worked as a cleaner in a Vaucluse mansion. Like, whatever I could get, I would do it, because I had no skills. And there was a lovely woman across the road who became a very good friend. She was also a Rajneesh, and she was working, sex working, in a brothel in Surrey Hills. And she said, Martina, you can make so much money quickly. And that really appealed to me, because I was desperate to get to America as fast as possible.
Did you have any qualms about it being sex work back then? I mean, what was your attitude to that?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I used to think, is there a conflict between being a spiritual seeker and a sex worker? But I quickly glossed over that and thought, no, I'm doing it for all the right reasons. I'm doing it to be with him, and he is the source of healing. I felt it's a social construct that sex work is bad. So I ended up getting a job in the city at a place called Penthouse, and I worked there probably for 18 months to save up the money to go over there.
What did it look like to your eyes, this brothel in Sydney?
I remember I used to ride my push bike to work from Darlinghurst to the city, and then I would carry it up the stairs and leave it in the locker room where we would have showers and get dressed and put on our makeup. It was a very friendly, welcoming place. So the boss was lovely, and I think he knew I was extremely inexperienced and naive. And the women there also were very caring and kind, and they kind of took me under their wing a bit. And so there were lots of lovely times working there.
Did it become just a job to you? Like, was it something that you could just do, like if you were cleaning at a factory?
It did become like a job. And I was so focused on the money. So I would, as I was working with a customer, I would add up the dollars in my head of, oh my God, I've already made $400 tonight. And so the money was an incredible motivator.
And you were already sharing some of that income with the Rajneesh.
Yes, I was. Yes.
How did that work?
So I think it was suggested that we send 10% of our income, and then later I sent 20% of my income to the Rajneesh Puram, the ashram. It was a 64,000-acre ashram, which is massive, and it needed a lot of money to fund it, because it had started from nothing.
So you were diligently sending off already part of your income over there, and then had managed to save up enough money yourself to fly over to this ashram, the city, Rajneesh Puram in Oregon. What did you see when you arrived? How did this place look to you?
It was incredible. It was surreal, because it's such a massive ashram. It had a man-made lake that we drove past when we entered the ashram in a bus. It had lots of buildings that were a bit like Swiss chalets, wooden buildings, but there were also lots of trailers where the Rajneeshis, the disciples, would live.
The real lure of you being in this place was to get to meet the guru. He'd taken a vow of silence by the time that you'd arrived, which is inconvenient, I guess, but he still was there present in the ashram. What was it like the first time that you actually set eyes on this man?
Oh, it was incredible. So, I mean, I had fallen in love with him for his words, but he no longer spoke words, and that was a massive loss. Being in silence meant he was really in his mansion 23 hours a day, But at lunchtime every day, he would get in one of his 84 Rolls-Royce and do what was called drive-by. And at drive-by, we all lined up on the side of the road. There were usually like 2,000-3,000 people living there. We'd line up on the side of the road and wait for him to drive past. He would drive slowly past and wave. And if he really liked someone, he would stop the car and he would gaze at that person with great love. And that was our ultimate goal, was to have him stop in front of us and gaze at us. And I was convinced he was going to do that.
It sounds like how I used to feel at rock concerts.
Exactly.
I was in the front row, like, pick me, pick me.
Pick me.
And exactly. Did that happen for you?
Do you know, the first day when I stood there, he stopped right in front of me and I was beside myself with excitement, and he was gazing through his, he was wearing Ray-Ban sunglasses. He gazed, I thought, at me, but I quickly realised actually he was gazing at the person standing next to me, and he gave her a beautiful red rose, handed it to her, and I stood there so rejected, so ashamed that I had worked so hard to get there only for him to ignore me. And I was there for a year and a half, I think. He never once looked at me or stopped to gaze at me.
So you only got the chance really once a day to even, for you to gaze at the guru as he drives past in his Rolls Royce. How else were you spending your time?
Yeah, so we had to work. And work was called worship. That's how they sold it to us. So we were worshipping for Rajneesh. But really, we worked really hard, 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. And I got given a very lowly job because I was a nobody, a lowly job on the pipe crew. And that meant I was digging ditches in the desert. And it was very hard work. I was not used to digging ditches. So we dug the ditches for irrigation pipes so we could irrigate the desert, and we grew all the vegetables there, and we grew tree seedlings and so on. And it was really, really hard work.
Hard work, not at all glamorous, but was there a kind of, you know, good fellow feeling with the
very much
adherents?
So, yeah.
What was the mood like as all that was happening?
We had a lot of fun. We really did. It was a great crew and we really had heaps of fun. And that was like my little family. You know, I'd always looked for a family because my family was a very unsafe family.
One of the things that distinguished the Rajneeshi movement from other New Age movements or, you know, religious movements at that time was the guru's attitudes to sex and relationships. What was your experience of all that?
Yeah, it was tough because I was then maybe 21 or 22, so I was one of the youngest women there, and I was definitely a magnet for predators. And because Rajneesh taught that there's, you know, sex is wonderful, be free, do whatever you want, don't get attached to anyone, have sex with whoever you want to. Relationships only tie you down. So I was targeted by many men and my self-esteem was so low that I would just go along and think, oh, he likes me, this is so wonderful. But I think it harmed me, and it took time once I left to really process that and grieve the things I lost by being targeted in the way that I was.
You mentioned, Martina, the guru's 83, 84 Rolls-Royces.
Yes.
And also famous for these very ostentatious watches and all these kind of displays of wealth.
Yes.
How did you feel about that side of the movement as your time digging ditches in the desert sun wore on?
Yes, I mean, slowly, slowly my doubts accumulated. Thank God, it was very gradual. But I remember the first time my doubt really planted a seed, a beautiful seed that eventually grew, where we were going to line up on the side of the road as we did after every lunchtime, and he was going to drive by and we would jump up and down with joy. But I thought, fuck it. I'm not doing it. I was really tired. So I went up the hill to my little A-frame and I lay down on the bed and read my book instead of lining up on the side of the road. And I had a beautiful, peaceful time. I even had a little nap. And I thought, this is wonderful. I'm being rebellious and it feels good. So that was the first time. Then the Rolls-Royce did get to me. I thought, everyone said, look, it's just it's a vehicle for him to stick his middle finger up the noses of conventional people. But I think he was actually, you know, really invested in these Rolls-Royces and Cartier watches and diamond-studded bracelets and so on. And I had a bit of distaste about that. And also I became really good friends with one of his jewellers. So he had like 4 or 5 full-time jewellers working for him. And they would have to sometimes pull 48-hour shifts to get whatever piece of jewellery ready for him as a gift. And if it didn't come on time, he would have a tantrum. And she shared that with me and I thought, no, I don't like it. And so these seeds were wonderful and accumulated over time.
Rajneesh's private secretary, Sheila, wielded a great deal of power at Rajneeshpuram, and at one point she ordered for a whole lot of homeless men to be brought in to the ashram from all parts of America. How did you feel about that at
Yes,
the time?
I remember Sheila held a public meeting and told us that we're going to share our home with homeless people. And I remember just being so excited. I thought, this is amazing. We're having a purpose now. We're making a difference. And 3,000 homeless, mostly men, some women, arrived in buses. And I remember I signed up. I left the pipe crew and signed up to serve meals and cook for the homeless people. And the scheme was called Share a Home. And all of these, you know, really vulnerable and, vulnerable people arrived. And, of course, they had a lot of problems because being homeless is hard. They had addictions, they had mental illness, and that was a lot. We were not at all prepared for that. And in order to deal with this, Sheila put Haldol, which is a tranquilizer, in the beer kegs. And so everyone was tranquilized.
Did you know that at
no,
the time?
No, I only found that out much later. So this is how she controlled the homeless people.
And it wasn't as simple as this generous impulse of sharing a home. What was the other motivation?
The motivation was there was going to be a local election, and Sheila wanted to win the election. So we needed 3,000 more Americans to vote, and that is why we brought them there. That was an entirely selfish motivation, which I didn't know about.
And what happened after the election, and which was won by the Rajneeshis?
Yeah, after the election, they were dumped on buses. They were loaded on buses and dumped back on the streets of Portland, Seattle, and they were given clothes and so on. They had to give back their warm jackets. As they got off the bus, they had to give back their warm jackets. And a friend of mine had to drive those homeless people and dump them in the middle of the night, in the middle of a strange city, and take their jackets off them. And I remember he was crying and felt so bad. And that was another nail in the coffin for me. I just thought, that is unforgivable.
And then suddenly the Rajneesh disappeared from the ashram. What had happened?
Yes, if anyone has watched Wild Wild Country, which is on Netflix, I really recommend watching it. It's a documentary about Rajneeshpuram. And in it, you see a lot of Sheila, who was his private secretary. And while he was in silence, she was the one who communicated with us. She'd say, he told me to tell you this, he said that. For example, she said, no one is allowed to be negative, because if you're negative, if you say or think anything negative, he will die, because he's so fragile that he will leave his body and die, basically silencing us. So she left with apparently $5 million of the money, and she went with her entourage of maybe 10 women. After that, he started speaking again publicly, and he denounced her. And he would talk every day for 2-3 hours. And he said, things are going to get better, things are going to change. And things did. We worked less. We weren't being whipped by Sheila and her crew, so we were more relaxed. But then, not that long after, maybe 2 months after that, he also disappeared in a Learjet. I remember watching the plane take off. I was on my way to lunch and I saw this plane take off. I didn't know it was him in it. And he had abandoned us without so much as a word.
He was on the run from charges of immigration fraud that eventually led to him leaving the United States. But in terms of the atmosphere among all of his devoted followers in the ashram, what was it like once word spread that he'd taken off?
It was very surreal. It was very surreal. We didn't know what to do. We didn't know where to go. Many people had to beg, borrow and steal to get tickets back home, like to Germany or Switzerland or Italy or South America, because we had no money. Many people left and started doing sex work and lap dancing and things like that because they had no money and no skills. I remember taking a few weeks to leave, and I had to ring up my mum and say, can you give me some money? I need to buy a ticket to come back to Australia. Yeah, it was so surreal. We felt a deep sense of loss.
So for you, Martina, did that kind of mark the end of your personal devotion to this guy, having seen the way it played out in terms of that ashram?
Yes, sadly not. You'd think so, but by then I was still only 23 or 24. My prefrontal cortex hadn't fully developed yet, and I was not a great thinker. And it was my whole world. So he settled again in his former ashram in India, in Pune. And soon everyone went to visit him over there. And I too went. I was in Australia saving up money and I went there. I was more doubt, full of doubt. And so I didn't go and live there. I went 3 times over 3 years and I would stay for maybe 2 months. So I was gradually moving away a bit.
So was there, you know, a turning point for you that allowed you to finally separate yourself from this cult?
Absolutely, yeah. It was a very sad day where we went to his talk every day. There'd be like hundreds of us in a big hall called Buddha Hall, and we would sit on the floor cross-legged and he would talk to us. And one day we were sitting there and waiting for him to come. And it went around the whole hall saying, Vivek has killed herself. And Vivek was a beautiful, she was his girlfriend. So she'd been his girlfriend since the beginning. She was a woman from the UK. And I always looked up to her. I wanted to be her because she was the closest to him. And I thought her life must be magical. But in fact, she'd left the ashram the night before and checked herself into a 5-star hotel nearby and had died by suicide.
How did Rajneesh talk about this woman who'd been such a close person to him over so many years?
Yeah, this is what really got me. He did not even mention her. He did not talk about her. He didn't say, she has been my most loyal person in my life. She has been a a godsend to me. He just ignored it. She was cremated that same night, so there was no funeral, there was nothing. People were saying she did the most selfish thing that anyone can do. And I remember listening to people and I thought, this is not right. It's not selfish to die by suicide. It's absolutely devastating. And anyone who does that is in the worst anguish. And so the next day I went into town in Pune and I booked my ticket home and I decided that's it, I'm leaving Rajneesh and I'm going to do my best to be a normal person in the normal world again.
What did you do with all your, you know, Rajneeshi clothing and, yeah, and sacred items?
I had so many. All my possessions were Rajneesh. So I had all his books. I had posters on the wall of him. He was quite photogenic, although when I look at him now, I think, what an ugly man. But I thought he was beautiful. I got rid of the mala, the necklace around my neck. There was a box he had sent me. It was a round sandalwood box with a toenail clipping of him.
A toenail? That makes Catholic relics look
above board. Oh, my goodness, yeah.
A toenail clipping.
I got rid of everything. I got rid of all my orange and pink and red clothes. I threw the mala and the box into the surf at Bondi. I cried and cried and cried. I changed my name back to Martina and I thought, no matter how hard it is, I am going to be Martina in the real world and find my way.
Starting with the easiest, most superficial bit of that, what did you choose to wear instead of all those pinks and purples?
Yeah, I caught the bus from Bondi to Bondi Junction and I went into Just Jeans and I bought two pairs of black jeans and some black T-shirts and some Doc Martens. I remember I kept them on. I said, can I wear them? And the lady cut off the tag and I dumped my red clothes into the bin and that was it.
What ended up becoming of Rajneesh, this guru that had kind of taken so many years of your life in a way?
He died shortly after Vivek, I think maybe 6 months after Vivek passed away. And no one really knows because he was only in his late 50s. He did have a fragile health, but there is a rumour, which I believe, that he got his doctor to end his life, to euthanize him.
For you, Martina, once you'd made this break from the Rajneeshis, what kind of state were you in?
After I left Rajneesh, I started having nightmares about my childhood sexual abuse. And then those nightmares also turned into daytime flashbacks. And they were like an avalanche. I couldn't hold it back. So somehow Rajneesh and being in the cult had protected me from having to face those memories. And all of a sudden I was just flooded with terrible memories of my uncle and grandfather. And I thought I was going mad. I ended up seeing a psychiatrist and he was very intimidating. He was so intimidating that, in fact, I never told him about having been in the cult, never told him about my memories of childhood abuse. And I remember he did the Beck Depression Inventory, which is a standardised psychometric test, and I came up extremely high on depression. And he just wrote me a script for Prozac and said, take one a day and you'll be fine. And it took all of 10 minutes, I think, this interview or this session, and I was back on Ocean Street and I had not received the help. If he had have delved a little bit deeper, if he'd asked the right questions, he might have got to it, but he was not a compassionate man.
Eventually you did find a psychologist
Yes. Who
you could be honest with. How did she help you?
So, yeah, she was amazing. Her name was Robbie, and I saw her probably for about 6-7 years. And she was the first person to believe me. I was able to disclose the abuse to her because she was such a safe, caring person. And we worked systematically through the years of abuse. And she guided me in a, you know, very gentle but also firm way and really mothered me. She mothered me, but with boundaries. It wasn't boundaryless. And just helped turn my life around. It was a very hard time to have to face all the memories, but she made it safe and possible. And she was the person who encouraged me to try university again. And that was a huge turning point.
What was so important about that, going to university?
Yeah, it was so wonderful to actually learn a profession and to learn about social justice, about feminism. And I was able to start to see my personal problems in a much bigger way. And I was able to then have a profession that I have loved for 30 years. And I've been able to contribute in a meaningful way. And that has really, I didn't have to work as a sandwich hand anymore or as a sex worker. I had a job and have a job that I truly love.
Delving into that awful time in your childhood, Martina, did it help give a different understanding for you about what had led you to the Rajneesh cult in the first place? How did you start to see that part of your history?
Yeah, so I was able to start seeing what had happened to me because at the time it was so heady, I didn't really see what I was doing and how I was escaping reality. I was like a child adoring her guru, her father figure, believing that he was going to save me. And then when I finally realised there's not going to be anyone that saves me but myself, that was groundbreaking and scary.
After you had made it out of the Rajneesh movement, you fell in love with a good man called Michael. The two of you eventually decided you wanted to have a baby together. What had been the Rajneesh's attitude towards women having kids?
Yes, so he said we should never become attached to anyone, so we shouldn't be in long-term relationships. Monogamy was for the sheep and we were lions. He also said women should not have children because it hinders their spiritual growth. And I really believed that because I also, as a child, had been thinking, I saw my mother's deep unhappiness and I thought, I'm never going to be a mum because it does not look attractive. And so it fitted my own beliefs. And so he got many people, many women and men, to sterilise themselves. In the years of Rajneesh Puram, that was 4 or 5 years, not one child was born. We all obeyed. We were all in our, you know, prime childbearing years, and yet not one of us had a child.
So what did that mean for you and Michael these years later?
Yeah, so that was huge. I had also subjected myself to sterilisation. And so when I met him, I remember saying to him, look, I don't want to have kids, so why don't you think about it and get back to me? I really liked him. And he went away and thought about it, and maybe 5 days later he rang me and said, yeah, I'm in. And so we started this beautiful and at first tumultuous relationship. And it wasn't until quite a few years later where I felt so safe with him and I'd had so much healing that I suddenly felt this craving to have a baby. It was because I was safe. And I think I was about 37, so my biological clock was also ticking, and suddenly I was just obsessed about, we're going to have a baby, Michael. And so I had microsurgery to reverse the sterilisation. And then we started trying, and it took a long, long time to fall pregnant. But I did. We did.
And this, as you're saying, you know, was something you desperately wanted. Why was a part of you scared as the months of your pregnancy progressed, scared about actually becoming a mother?
Yeah, that was, it's one of the hardest times of my entire life. So being pregnant at first, I was ecstatic. We were just walking on cloud nine together, Michael and I. But not that long after falling pregnant, I started having horrific fears about being a bad mother. I felt that I might harm the baby, really believing that I was going to be a terrible mother. And it was such a painful time. I was being seen by a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist called it perinatal psychosis. And I was a mess and convinced that I would hurt the baby. And I was booked in to a mother and baby unit. As soon as our daughter was born, we would go to the mother and baby unit. And it was just such a sad, I look back on that time and I think, oh, Martina, you didn't deserve that.
So you had all this awful fear that you would harm your baby. When she arrived, what happened to all those fears?
They all lifted. It was like butterflies that just were floating through the birthing unit. And I knew without a doubt I would never hurt her. And she's 26 now, and I have never hurt her, you know, in big T ways. I'm sure often I've said the wrong thing or been impatient, but I have never harmed her physically or psychologically.
So what was all that about? How do you understand it, that terrible fear?
Yeah, God, it was so hard. I think it was the way my mother had mothered me. And a lot of it was unconscious, so it was what happened pre-verbally. My mother was so unwell, mentally unwell, that she harmed me. And she harmed me perhaps especially because I was a girl.
Did having your own daughter change anything in the relationship between you and your mum, who was still alive at that point?
Not until much later. So I really wanted to protect my daughter from my mother because she was so bitter and she said terrible things. I used to only let them come and stay for 3 nights. That was my max. And they might come and stay once a year or once every 2 years for 3 nights. And I remember one time it was Easter Sunday and my daughter was eating lots and lots of chocolate Easter eggs and bunnies. And I remember my mum, who was weight obsessed, saying, "You are getting fat and fatter," to my daughter, who was 5 at the time. "Your cheeks are fat," in her German accent. And I remember later that day, my daughter sat on my lap and whispered in my ear really loudly. She said, "I don't like that lady." And I remember saying to my mum, "You can't say those things. We have a body shame-free zone here. We never comment on bodies or weight." And she just dismissed that as stupid. So that is why I protected my daughter largely from my mum.
Did your mum confide finally in you about her own experiences as a little girl in that family that had also done this damage to you?
Yeah, she did. So that was a few years later. She did disclose that her brother and father sexually abused her too. They are the two men that sexually abused me. And I felt such compassion for her, and I could understand her, you know, mental illness much better. And it changed things for me, even though I also felt, how could she have left me there knowing what her father and brother were capable of? And I still can't answer that.
It's many years on now from these traumatic parts of your early life, but also the time in the Rajneeshi movement. What place do those traumatic events have in your day-to-day life now?
The Rajneesh took a while actually to get over and to forgive myself for. I was so hard on myself for having been such a naive person. It took a long time for me to forgive myself and to think, it's okay, Martina, you did the best you could. You really believed, you still had magical thinking, like a child. And now I'm quite the opposite. I have very realistic thinking. But it took time. And yes, I did regret the sex work and the Rajneesh time. But now I have a great deal of fondness for that silly young woman I was, who really believed good things were going to happen to me as a Rajneeshi.
Is there anything that you kind of still feel had a positive side to it, or that you're grateful for from those years in that world, in that movement?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I still have friends who were with me in the cult and who also escaped, and they are wonderful women, and we have a great deal of laughter now when we talk about our years in the cult. And we are very close because we've all been rescued or rescued ourselves from the shackles of the cult. And we see the world in a particular way as a result.
Well, I guess you went into that partly seeking real human connection, and it sounds like that's one thing you've managed to
Beautiful.
Rescue on the other side of it.
Yeah, very much so.
Martina, it's really a remarkable story that you tell. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
Thank you, Sarah. It's been wonderful talking to you.
Podcast, broadcast. This is Conversations with Sarah Kanoski.
Dr. Martina Zanger was my guest. Martina's memoir is called Not My Shame. This Conversations was produced by Maggie Morris and recorded on the lands of the Turrbal and Yagara peoples. Our executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.